Every couple of months, a question comes. One of the most common questions asked on the spiritual path: how do I know who is my guru? How do I find my guru? Now, this question is also asked by those who don't believe in the concept of a guru. Many of us living in modern cities, modern society, feel we don't need a guru, because the word guru has a lot of associations with it, mostly negative, and being judged by society that I'm weak, so I need a guru, trusting someone who's wearing orange robes, and so on and so forth. A lot of collective conditioning about this word guru. So let's approach this from a different angle. I would say life prepares you for a guru, and then the guru prepares you for life. Life prepares you for a guru. What does this mean? At whatever age you may be, you have accumulated experiences of life, like all of us, which have made you question what life is about. You have received setbacks, blows, loss of various kinds, material, relationship, whatever it may be. And you ask yourself, is this life worth living? Is this what life is about? If I lose a loved one, is this the purpose of life? Is there any point in loving someone if I'm going to lose them? So the experiences of life and living thus far are the preparation. Life prepares you for the guru. Now, what is the guru? The guru in the manifest world, in the world of forms, is a form, a being, so to speak. How can life prepare you for a being? Doesn't make sense, really. So we have to ask ourselves, what does the guru represent? Perhaps someone who can reduce my suffering, someone who has seen the challenges of life and who can guide me, someone I can look up to as my higher ideal. In other words, a force which I trust, because I have a limited capacity to deal with life. I have faced my failures, my losses, and so on and so forth. So on this journey of life, the journey of finding out what is life about, I come across books, various teachers, and different teachings appeal to me. They make sense. But then I ask myself, which is that one which I feel is closest to my heart? Maybe I don't even understand the words. Half the things this person is saying don't make sense to me. But when I see that person, when I am with that person, I feel comfortable, at ease, and more peaceful than otherwise. Now, what has happened is benevolent consciousness has taken a form which is recognized by you, recognized. A form has come in front of you in the manifestation, and you feel, this is where I feel home. This is my home. So it is true that when the student is ready, the master appears. If we go about searching for a guru, we are using our minds. There's nothing wrong in that. It is a process. But we tend to go about searching without having a criteria for the search. And then we get enamored. Different gurus talk about different things, different subjects, different experiences, and we find we are following all of them. But the guru is nothing but a reflection of my higher self. The guru is nothing but a reflection of my higher self, not my limited mind-based self. My mind is what has given me sleepless nights when life has thrown surprises at me. Now I'm tired, and by divine grace, an opportunity is presented where a form comes in front of me and starts not only changing my perspectives on life, my attitude on life, but is delivering me deep peace. Now, this form is completely neutral and objective. It has no interest in you as an individual. It is only a mirror. It is a mirror to your higher self. Your own higher self projects itself onto a form, and that form starts talking to you. That form starts saying things which appeal to you, to your heart. It is true. The Guru is apart from you only as a body, but the Guru is yourself. Arjuna's higher self was Krishna. Appears as Krishna and Arjuna the charioteer. Appears as two. Now what happens? When I start imbibing the teachings, looking at life through this different lens, this new way of being, this new way of thinking which has been introduced to me, now I can test it in my own personal experience. Is it so? Is that right? And I find by and by, when some challenge arises in life, I am now seeing it through this new lens which has been placed over my eyes. I find the light of divine wisdom now operating through me, whereas earlier, it was all about the poor me and my story and battling through life, fighting with people, defending myself, and so on and so forth. Now, a challenge comes, and I know what comes unasked is what is meant for me, pleasure or pain. So rather than fighting with God, fighting with people, now I am focused on dealing with the situation at hand. Rather than building monuments of stories about why people did things to me and said things to me and so on and so forth, the earlier preoccupations of the me are given up now. When something good happens, I feel very happy, and I thank God that it was my destiny to feel happy. Pleasure arises, but no pride. When an unfortunate event happens at work maybe, or in my personal life, pain will arise. And that pain is also seen as a movement. But because the mind is no longer analyzing this pain till kingdom come, trying to make sense of it like it used to earlier, I find I am at peace with the pain. And so by and by, the realization comes that the Guru is now leading my life. Life has prepared me for the Guru. Now the Guru is preparing me for life, leading me. Now I have discovered a new way of managing myself that I didn't have before. And the hallmark of this is that I feel more and more at peace than I did before. I feel more and more at peace means my thinking mind, which was earlier creating havoc for me with blame, condemnation, hatred, malice, ill will, spite, jealousy, pride, arrogance, guilt, shame, and so on and so forth, has got destroyed. The Guru is like a wall, but not a wall which is in front of you. Imagine you are leaning against a wall, fully straight. The back of your heels, your spine, your shoulder blades, and your head are all resting on the wall. That support is behind you. And now you are moving through life with this wall behind you, the support. Not as the little me navigating through life's trials and tribulations, trying to rule the world, dominate and control others, manipulate situations. Now, the support of consciousness, the wall of consciousness, is behind me all the time, which constantly tells me, Thy will be done. Not my will, O Lord, but Thine be done. So when I face a challenge, I rest back into that wall. When I think people are the doers of their actions, I again rest back into it. Because that is consciousness, the witness, the pure being, which one could say I got disassociated with as the divine plan in the journey of life, considering myself separate from. So, as the saying goes, you can leave the guru, but the guru will not leave you. Now, what does that mean? Once the new way of being has been shown to you, it cannot get out of your system because it was already introduced into your consciousness. There is an incident in Nisargadatta Maharaj's attic when he was giving satsang and a foreigner walked in, looked around, maybe heard the conversation for a minute or two and left. And Maharaj replied, "Too late. The fact that he has come here, stepped inside here, it means the seed has been planted. When it will sprout is God's will." So something has appealed to you. It means the seed has already been planted. And what is the quality of the guru? Quietness, silence. Maharaj said, realized people are very quiet. It doesn't mean that they take mourn or in silence all the time. What it means, their mind is very quiet. And yes, it does also mean that they don't speak the way the average human being speaks. Because the average human being, most of the speech is based on doership, not so for the sage. So it doesn't mean you can't discuss a nice restaurant with a sage or maybe going on a nice holiday somewhere. The sage is a human being. But what we average people indulge in, as far as our speech is concerned, that does not happen for the sage. His speech, devoid of doership, does not carry the weapons that our speech does. Gorakh kahe suno e avdhut, jag mein aise rehna. Gorakh kahe suno e avdhut, jag mein aise rehna. Kaan se suno, aankh se dekho, lekin munh se kuch nahi kehna. Gorakhnath says, "Listen, O wise one, how to live in this world? Listen with your ears, see with your eyes, but don't speak." Now, why did Gorakhnath single out speech? What was he trying to tell us? Obviously, we have to speak, otherwise life will not happen. But what he was trying to say is, listening and seeing are passive. I hear sounds all the time. I don't have to do anything to hear. I see all the time. When my eyes are open, consciousness is streaming into me. Do I have to do anything to see? But when it comes to speech, that is a tricky one. Because most of what I am speaking is based on hardwired conditioning. Things I have been taught. Things I have been made to believe in. How my parents spoke to me. What religion they belong to. What income group they belong to. And so I find that I am just speaking other people's thoughts all the time. Someone told me 1 plus 2 equals 3, so I'm saying 1 plus 2 equals 3. And then when I start speaking, I speak as if I know the truth, as if my view is the only view, as if what I say is the right thing to say. So one could say there's a sense of doership involved in speech and a higher degree of ignorance. That is why Siddharameshwar Maharaj said, we are all babbling in illusion, giving freely our advice, free distribution of opinions and views, without realizing that most of them are not ours in the first place. So silence, quietness, calm become the hallmarks of the new way of being. If someone's nature is to be lively, meet people, be friendly, it does not mean changing that nature. It means honoring that. But the mind, the thinking mind, is shut down. Someone may be an introvert, prefers the silence, prefers the quietness, is not a people's person, and stays according to their true nature. What we want is the quiet ones want to talk and the talkative ones want to be quiet. And the quiet ones want to tell the talkative ones to talk less. And the talkative ones want to tell the quiet ones to talk more. I have been with yogis who could talk from sunrise to sunset. And we just have to sit and listen to them. But they are yogis. They can reach planes of existence you have no idea of. So this guru becomes the guru principle. The guru consciousness becomes the guru principle, which starts guiding you through life, through the rest of your journey on this planet. Earlier, the me with its sense of doership, which operated as a separate entity in life, trying to protect itself, now is released. And the guru principle starts guiding one through the journey of life. So what happens? A constant recalibration and reinterpretation of my understanding of life. Situations keep coming up. Family related, work related, friends related, income related. That is the journey of life. But it gets constantly reinterpreted in the light of the guru principle. Why reinterpreted? Because most of our conditioning takes place in our formative years without our knowing it. It becomes hardwired, thick. How our siblings treated us, parents treated us, teachers, that shapes us. And now this becomes our constant, the way we look at things and situations. So it is very challenging to come out of that. We find we are helpless in patterns, we keep repeating the same patterns, although now we have the knowing, the understanding, but it keeps coming up and we can only witness it helplessly. But that source, that consciousness which has brought this awareness to us, one surrenders to that. I can't do it on my own. Now I am in your hands. That requires trust. Not trusting the guru as an individual, trusting yourself. It's got nothing to do with the guru. For some people, it's very quick to identify a guru. For some people, it takes time. For me, it took time because I was quite ignorant about these concepts of guru, self-realization, enlightenment, awakening. I had not heard of any of this. It was new language for me. For some people, it's instant. Some people want 2-3 gurus, one as the fallback for the other. That also happens. That is how the mind works. So when you find that by and by now I am looking through life in a different way, my past comes back to haunt me, so be it. My troubles don't go away, so be it. But if I can be grateful that at least I have something now which I didn't have before, and just gratitude to God for only that, then one could say the job is done. At it is only a matter of time. But if I find that I think I am at peace, equanimity and calm, and I tell the world about it, now I am at peace, I am calm, but I find I am criticizing and condemning people and hating them, and I have fixed views about them, then I have fooled myself. Then I have fooled myself. So you see, these are the qualities of the self. Peace, silence, quietude are qualities of the one self, not of the little mind. The little mind is the troublemaker. When we say peace of mind while we are addressing the egoic mind, because that is how you talk to egos, how egos understand each other, what is actually happening is the qualities of the self are being imbued in this little mind, that witness. The yogi will say being in the Sushumna Nadi, the central Nadi, not the left, not the right, no polarities. That is a quality of the self. And as I'm reintroduced to the self, I can observe the mind and its prattle and chatter and talk when it starts happening. I'm aware of it. Can't do anything about it because it's playing out its game. It's playing out its number. But being the witness of that is more than enough. Because that will eventually burn to ash when it is witnessed. Because we are not adding fuel to the fire. Earlier, we were adding fuel to the fire by getting involved in it, blaming ourselves or blaming others for being the reasons for it. Now, even that is given up. This third eye, not the eyes of duality, but the third eye, the single eye, if thine eye be single, thy whole body will be full of light, is the self, the faculty of discrimination, wisdom. These are the eyes of the me, the eyes of duality. The third eye cannot be seen, the eye of Shiva. M, why don't you get a stool for yourself? Why be so uncomfortable? There's one in the kitchen. Are you okay? You see how subtle it is? Problem is, subtleties get missed. Why? No dazzling bright lights, no Shaktipat experience, no experience of the self. It gets missed. No siddhis. The best sadhana, offer your troubles to the self, offer the person troubling you to the self, offer your troubled mind to the self. That's all you need to do. I can't handle it. I offer it. So simple, yet very hard for the me. This quest to be a better person. Rather, let it be a quest to be more peaceful. Leave the being a better person to someone else. Because being a better person means you're still a person only. You're coming from Rishikesh. So from the Kumbh Mela, you went to Rishikesh. You could extricate yourself from the Kumbh. Or was it challenging? You have the mic? Does anyone have the mic?
I think every time I tried to come, it was just an adventure. Kumbh was one of them. The first hours and days seem very harsh and tough. But when it's all over, it feels like a blessing.
And how long did it take you from there to Rishikesh?
24 hours? I went by fast.
And you came to Bombay yesterday?
2 hours ago?
Tired?
Was. Same example as Kumbh. Seems hard. Then when it goes away, it's like the way it was supposed to be.
And when things go hard, to have this understanding that it's the way it's supposed to be, to have this understanding when things are going hard, is a beautiful gift. It doesn't mean they won't be hard, but it means one is not complaining. Simplifies everything. Fear may still arise. How do I get out of it? How do I reach it? Will there be modes of transport? The mind is going to operate like that. But that acceptance itself is so beautiful. So, what do you feel brings you here?
I don't think I could put it a word or a symbol to justify it. It just brings me here.
Should I tell you? It is love. Now, this love is the love of the self, the love of truth, the love which does not have a polaric opposite. Only that love, the recognition of that love, makes one ignore time and space. It is as simple as that. And you are quite right. You can't put it into words. It's a futile attempt. That love, parents can't give a child. Friends can't give friends. Lovers can't give lovers that love. That is the love where someone like Ramakrishna also cried out to Kali, seeing the poverty of Vivekananda, and said, Mother, why are you doing this to him? This love for truth is the purest form of love. It is the love for truth. Would anyone like to ask anything or share anything? Yes, Seema.
I'd like to know if one can think of the universe as a guru.
Why not? Ramana Maharshi had the mountain as his guru, Arunachala. But then, by universe, would it mean that everyone you come across is your guru? Do you mean it that way, or do you mean it another way?
I mean it in another way because I feel all that is around us and beyond that is like a guru.
Yes, and within us too, around us, beyond us, within us, is the Guru.
No, because when I think of the universe, I feel it's so vast. That vastness is what I think of all the time.
That's beautiful. Do you know there is more space in your body than materiality? The amount of space in each atom between the cells of the body, it is vastness appearing condensed. You see, vastness is a good tool or pointer because it breaks me from the limitation of the form. Expansive, all-pervasive, these are the qualities of vastness, as opposed to the little me. So by all means, that becomes your sadhana.
Even when I think of the vastness, I feel that whole of humanity, all of us, is like a even less than a tiny speck of dust. You know, when we see dust, we see a layer of it. In that are the tiny, tiny ones which forms the dust. So I feel that speck of dust is what we are in the universe.
What you are seeing here are specks of dust. Each body is a speck of dust being seen in the vastness of consciousness. Consciousness is formless, vast, within which forms arise. It is the same vastness you call the vastness of the universe. You will agree the sun is a huge object in the sky. How vast must you be to be able to see the sun? You will agree that the space between your form and my form would fill up at least 3 or 4 bodies between us. Isn't it vast? The space between you and me is vast. So this vastness is always ever present, within which forms appear. Now can you, now when you look at me, look at the vastness between us? No, because our eyes are designed to see forms, we ignore the space between us. But that space is necessary. But it is ignored because it is without form. So if I can be aware that this vastness of the universe is always ever present with me, then I am resting in the self. I mean, see how vast you are right now. You can hear the crows. They are appearing, the sounds are appearing within the vastness of your consciousness. Even my voice is appearing at the same time when the crows are doing their job. How vast consciousness is. So if you can place your attention on the vastness, attention is placed on consciousness, not on objects in consciousness or anything, especially an irritating thing. If something is triggering me, someone is triggering me, but my attention is on vastness, on consciousness itself, would I get triggered to the same degree as I did earlier?
And as you mentioned, since I've been coming here, we've been talking about the thinking mind and the working mind. Now I can, you know, actually see that my thinking mind is working now. So just cut it off.
That's it. Earlier we were blind to it and we got involved in the thinking. Now the awareness arises that the thinking mind is in operation and doing its job. That is more than enough. Because it means you are reintroduced to the witness. The one who is aware that the thinking mind is going on. And it is in this fire of witnessing that the thinking mind will start burning to ash. It doesn't need your help. The thinking mind thinks it can annihilate the thinking mind. That is how the ego operates. I'm in charge. I can even quieten my thinking mind. You are the thinking mind. But this vastness is very beautiful. Thank you for sharing this. Because this vastness is available for everyone. In that, it loses its grip. When I used to, in my younger days, fly into Mumbai and look out of the window and see millions of buildings and each building flats, each flat, human beings, this thought would come to me. And one death happens in one small flat, it's of no consequence. But if it happens to be my flat, my life, my people, it's everything. But if you have this vast view, you're above it all, and you're seeing the whole thing, you see one life playing out through many forms. And that vastness will include those who trouble you and those who love you. And in the final analysis, on the day of judgment, the realization will come. Both taught me equal lessons. While my focus was on the one who troubled me, this vastness made me realize these are the polaric opposites in life. Good and evil, good and bad, beautiful and ugly, which I got mesmerized by. Now I am free of that mesmerism. Of course, we rather have loved ones around us than those who have troubled us around us. Of course, but I have seen through personhood and blaming people, seeing the hand of God, of consciousness, of the source, of totality, above and behind everyone.
And I like, the way you're saying, look at things like you're not the doer, because sometimes when there is some, say, argument between friends, and then I analyze it and say, all right, I'm not the doer. Someone else is making me do it. So I've always thought of that when things are a little.
Sure, and nor are the others doing.
Yes, that's true. That's how.
It negates each other. It negates each other. Two negatives make a positive. We learned that in school. They cancel each other out. As it is, it's all canceled out in deep sleep. That is the joke. All your arguments are canceled out in deep sleep. The ones you love are canceled out in deep sleep. The ones you hate are canceled out in deep sleep. So it would be fair to say that the ones you love and the ones you hate are equally irrelevant in deep sleep. It's a bit shocking to hear that, right? It is. It is meant to shock. It is meant to wake up to the understanding that this is the living dream of life. Send your blessings and love to those who have troubled you. We don't know what demons and challenges they are facing, what their karmic blueprint is, what their journey is. But because they are harming me, I withhold that quality from them. That is what I do. Even if I can't get myself to say words to them, I wish them well in my heart. That in this instance, we don't get along. In this instance, you have hurt me. But I wish no one else hurts you the way you hurt me. Even that wish will arise because you know what it is to be hurt. Even that wish will arise. That is the healing. That is the healing consciousness. Joel Goldsmith would call it the healing consciousness. The full reliance on the infinite invisible, which is the vastness, the infinite invisible. Giving up the belief in two powers. Giving up the belief in two powers that giving up that belief that there's a power apart from God which is operating in my life is the healing consciousness. So even if I'm in a situation with somebody which is extremely challenging, of course I have to deal with it. But that person, that situation cannot be apart from God because nothing can be apart from God. So I'm no longer fighting with hatred against that situation or that person. But yet I must fight. Arjuna had to fight, but without the sense of doership. That is what made him pick up the bow and arrow because his higher self, Krishna, said, I, as time, have already killed them. So you have to follow your dharma. For example, if you feel some wrong is being done, it doesn't mean sitting back and being passive about it, unless it's your nature and you're fine in that. But if it's not your nature, seeing the situation, thinking for yourself, taking your decision, but knowing that the one power is acting through everyone, yet I must do what I think and feel I should do. So I am no longer targeting a person, but the situation. And I'm dealing with the situation at hand. So simple. My obsession with people is over. My obsession with individuals is over. My obsession with personhood is over. As individuals apart from God, that is finished. And things like getting back, revenge, all these words start losing their power. I just do what I have to do in a given situation. If I have to safeguard myself, I must. Protect my interests, I must. So be it.
So if to find a teacher or anything, like we have been to various paths in life. Because when we were a child, let's say, we were introduced to Swami Chinmayanand. And then when I grew up, I was very fond of Yoganand because I used to read a lot of books from him and everything. And then a few years back, like I used to listen to Ramesh Ji also and a lot of Alok Das talks and all those things. And then I was going to a temple journey and I was sitting at Chidambaram, just sitting there. And a person came and I said, I want to visit Valar temple. He said, I stay there. Whenever you come, you meet me. Chidambaram. I was in Chidambaram. So there I was going to run that Valar temple. It's a few kilometers from there. So he said, you visit me. I was reluctant to call him actually. He gave me his number. So I just called him when I visited the temple. He said, just wait, I have to come and meet you. And then he came and he handed over a packet to me. And so I did not know what was it inside it, but they were all the blessing packets from the mother. He told me that in the night, mother came to him and said, you hand over this thing to him. That was the first time I went to the Samadhi at Pondicherry. And it came just like that to me. So then, now when I think about it, like Shraddhaluji told me that things is, you have been chosen for the teacher chooses you before you try and choose a teacher. And then that is something I'm very grateful to.
The same mother has sent you here to clarify aspects of the same teaching.
Yes.
Amazing.
So when I was at the center, like meditating, like Santosh Mas, I could feel huge presence, and I was lucky that I could meet her last time. So though I've been going through a lot of trouble on personal fronts, a lot of people cheated us completely. We lost our home and everything now. But at least with the help of the Divine Mother and all her loved ones around me, he has kept me alive.
The biggest test is to see grace through hardship. Hasn't the Mother said that?
Yes.
I mean, it would help if the Divine Mother gave us less hardships.
Sure. So I was listening to one of the talks of Aurobindo, and he said, and that they don't invite people to come when the darshans were there. So Nalinida invited one person, and Sri Aurobindo said that you have done a very wrong thing. He is not for this path. But he said that I have done it now, and he said now he has entered and taken a darshan. So his life will be very tough. But then Sri Aurobindo said that okay, now that it is done, I will support him. And it was, and then I was listening to another talk, and he said that there was a poet, and Sri Aurobindo said that if you go out from the ashram, you will become one of the most recognized poet in English literature. But if you stay in the ashram, the life would be very bad for you. But I will support you. So I always, so there is this path where I feel that every time the world expects that once you are on a spiritual path, things should be very easy and brightful. But that's not there. There is no path of miracles or anything. There may be more, a little more hardship or
much
challenges,
more
much more hardship. So I spoke to one person from the Integral Yoga, and I was listening to Rohit's Integral Yoga talks, and he said that the path of Aurobindo is the most difficult because it does not let you rest anywhere. And most of the people are interested that you do have a downfall. So I was thinking, but then whenever I go to Auro or when I come here or anything, I find peace and I find that whatever it may be, the mother is taking care of things.
That's beautiful. You know the saying, it's even in our scriptures, the story about, I forget now, who was it with Krishna, and they go to a man who is very rich and Krishna says, I will shower him with more riches. And then they go to a poor man who has only one cow, and Krishna says, I will even take away this one cow, you see. And he is asked why. And he said, I'll give the one who's rich more riches so he gets more lost in the Maya and then eventually finds his way to me. And this poor man has only one cow left. If I take that away, he'll come to me immediately. But there's a science behind this. To him that hath more shall be given, and to him that hath not, what he hath shall be taken away. To him that hath more shall be given. It's the same thing. To him that hath not, even the little that he hath shall be taken away. There's a deep meaning behind this, which unfortunately we don't have time to go through today.
But there was also one thing, just 2 minutes. So I had this thinking of the same thing which I was doing. So then in the retreat, and even yesterday I had a discussion. He said, look at life or your soul as a challenge being offered to you. But do not look at it as a punishment or anything. Let go that belief that there is karma or things, because on the new path, when you actually are getting into the integral thing, the path says that there is nothing like karma. So the whole thing, belief is that the soul is evolving and always have, and let go of all the old beliefs, the old ways of thinking, because that is the only way that you can meet these challenges and grow up fast. So that was something very insightful, and it took me at least 1 year to understand what Shraddhaluji were telling me. Yesterday's lecture made me understand that.
Takes time. That's why it's important to attend satsang.
Yes.
Because something will be said in one talk which is not said in another talk, which will hit home. Satsang is the constant company of truth. All the sages say, be in the company of satsang, be in the company of satsang. That's how it works. But now to just make the mood a bit lighter, since it became so heavy. This thing about God giving difficulties to those on the spiritual path, more than their share of difficulties, it reminds me of a joke I read in one of the books, where Saint Teresa is working in the field, very devout follower of Jesus, pushing a wheelbarrow full of soil, and it's very hard, and she's sweating, the sun is burning, and then she gives up, and she calls out to Jesus. She says, Jesus, me, your devout follower, you're doing this to me, such hardship. And Jesus replies, saying, don't worry. I only give these tasks to few of my chosen friends. And she looks up and tells Jesus, well, Jesus, no wonder you don't have any. What to do? Can't do anything. What comes unasked has to be faced.